Sehr geehrte Damen und Herren, ich darf nun überleiten zur anschließenden Podiumsdiskussion mit vier Menschen, die Dokumentargeschichte geschrieben haben oder sie gegenwärtig noch schreiben. Ich freue mich auf die ehemaligen und die aktuelle künstlerische Leitung der Dokumenta. Ich freue mich auf Roger M. Bürgel, Caroline Christoph Bakajew, Adam Simczyk und Naomi Beckwith. Wir haben, das will ich auch ganz unzweifelhaft deutlich machen und sagen, alle ehemaligen künstlerischen Leitungen zu diesem Festakt eingeladen. Aber nicht alle haben zusagen wollen oder zusagen können. Rudi Fuchs wäre gerne hier gewesen. Er hat uns angerufen und mitgeteilt, dass er aus gesundheitlichen Gründen nicht kommen kann. Aber er lässt uns und Sie sehr herzlich grüßen. Moderieren wird die anschließende Diskussion Saskia Trebing, die Ihnen zwar gleich die künstlerischen Leitungen vorstellen wird, die sich aber selbst nicht vorstellen kann, weshalb ich diese Rolle an dieser Stelle sehr gerne für Sie übernehme. Saskia Trebing, geboren in Bad Hersfeld, also ganz in der Nähe, ist Kunsthistorikerin und Journalistin und sie lebt in Berlin. Als Redakteurin arbeitet sie beim Kunstmagazin Monopol und schon seit ihrer Zeit als Volontärin bei der HNA gehört sie zu den besonders engen und besonders kompetenten BegleiterInnen der Dokumente. Liebe Saskia Trebing, ich darf das Wort nun an Sie übergeben und unsere künstlerischen Leitungen und Sie auf die Bühne bitten und das unter einem großen Applaus. Schön, dass Sie heute hier sind.
Good evening. Also from my side, we're going to switch to English now. I hope this is okay. And if you want translation, you can still get it at the entrance. And yeah, a very good evening. It's quite impressive to see so many Documenta participants, friends, lovers, enablers, maybe critics and skeptics as well here tonight. And my colleague said to me yesterday, this is the closest that the art world can get to stadium rock. And maybe that's quite fitting because we're talking about Documenta, which is quite a special institution that the German Historical Museum, the DHM in Berlin, called this great wild thing, ein großes wildes Ding. And so we have quite a job to do here on the podium because we're talking about 70 years of Documenta in about an hour, so I guess we get going right away. And I'm very glad and very honored to have so many people with so much experience and expertise on the podium. A warm welcome to Roger M. Bürgel, Caroline Christoph Bakajew, Adam Simczyk, and Naomi Beckwith. I don't think I have to do too much of an introduction because most of you already know these people on the podium, but I'm going to make a quick chronological round, starting with Roger M. Bürgel, born in Berlin and based in Switzerland right now. And he was a freelance curator when he was appointed director of Documenta 12 in 2007. Well, you were not appointed, but Documenta 12 was in 2007, and you curated and shaped it together with Ruth Noack. And some of you will probably remember the concept of the migration of form and the Aue Pavilion and the attempt to grow poppies in front of the Friedrichianum, which worked in the end, and the project to grow rice in the Bergpark, which almost worked, but is still, I think, remembered by many in Kassel. Welcome. And you're still a writer and curator, and in an interview from 2007, I read that you wish to be bored again. Did that wish come true?
To be what?
To be bored again after Documenta.
Yeah, of course. I mean, boredom is a precondition of creativity. So, yes, I mean, I need to get bored. I mean, hopefully not this evening.
Exactly. That was the thing. It's not an option tonight. And we already heard that there's this direct connection between the 7,000 palm trees of Cosima von Bonin and your Documenta. Actually, in this room, there was the work of Cosima von Bonin at Documenta 12. And so they're now all over Kassel. Is this what you meant by the migration of form?
Well, I mean, I don't own any concept, right? And of course, I mean, you don't have to tell Cosima what to do. But basically, the migration of form is not about things. I mean, it's here.
But it also works. I guess Documenta is a kind of super spreader for ideas as well that keep reappearing in different forms.
But you should be careful as soon as art starts to work.
We will. Okay, so let's get to Carolyn Christoph Bakadiev. You're based in Italy, but you're also traveling a lot, it seems, I heard. And you were artistic director of Documenta 13, which took place in Kassel, but not only in Kassel. It had outposts in Kabul and in Alexandria and in Cairo and in Banff in Canada. And we will talk about this later, what this meant for Documenta. And I think a lot of people remember works like the Pinona tree that you brought to Kassel, another kind of tree. So we have a long history of trees in Documenta. And also a dog with a pink leg called Human. And when I asked you what you're doing at the moment, you said you're retired, but you also then talk a lot about a lot of projects that you are realizing after you left the Castello di Rivoli in Turin that you directed, I think, for 21 years. For example, you did the big Arte Povera show in Paris. So do you only do the nice things now?
Es ist so schön, zurück zu sein.
It is great to have you here.
But to answer your question, I have always done only what I want to do. And I continue in my retirement.
And we already mentioned the Pinona tree. You had the plan to visit it in the Auer Park. Have you done so?
Yes, I went to check.
How is it doing?
Was a little sapling. The Pinona tree is not just the bronze tree with the stone, which in any case we brought with Giuseppe also as a homage to the 7,000 oaks, of course. He knew. But the artwork is also the relationship between the tree and the little sapling next to it. And the little sapling is fine. I checked with my dog Vago yesterday.
That's great. Adam Cimce actually tried to find a tree at Documenta 14. I wasn't so successful. Maybe you can remind me.
Yeah, you should have tried harder.
Yes.
Since we are talking about trees, for lack of a better subject, especially subjects political, we won't escape politics.
No.
In any case. And, you know, there was a tree, or there was an attempt to make a new tree by an artist from Kosovo, so-called Beciri, who asked at a certain point, you know, for permission to use just one branch from one of the 7,000 famous oaks of Kassel from Josef Beuys, and then we ran into a sort of like nearly a legal dispute over the issues of ownership of an idea or of an oak or of I don't know what. Anyway, by Nacht und Nebel, we managed to obtain one such branch, and now it's all history because, you know, this branch was then sort of grafted onto a very different kind of oak next to the Athens Polytechnic, which was then full of graffitis. And one of those graffitis, namely, "Being safe is scary," was then brought to the front of Fridericianum, replacing the, you know, brass lettering of Museum Fridericianum with this sort of rendering of the Athens graffiti "Being safe is scary" from around 2014 in bronze letters instead of the facade of the Museum of Enlightenment. So it was right in front of the Fridericianum where these two trees were, from which we managed to obtain the said branch of the tree. So there were some trees, but there will be more plans to talk about.
I promise we get back to the Fridericianum and the letters there, but let me just have a quick introduction of Adam Cimcik, of you as well. Adam Cimcik was director of the Kunsthalle in Basel when he was appointed director of Documenta 14. And actually, I think the 60th birthday of Documenta was one of the first major appearances he had in Kassel 10 years ago with a symposium and a memorable concert with Hiva Kha, who also did some of the monumental works of Documenta 14. And a lot has happened since then. You made us learn from Athens. You had two openings of Documenta, one in Athens, one in Kassel, and two exhibition locations. People on Kassel, I think, remember mostly the very monumental Parthenon of Books, for example. And at the moment, you're also still curating, thinking, writing, and working for Kunsthaus Zürich. So we're glad you made it here from Zurich, in spite of a very adventurous train ride, apparently. And I think the last time you were very present in Kassel was on screen, on a cinema screen, because you were the protagonist of the film Exergue, a 14-hour documentary about Documenta 14 that traveled international film festivals like Berlinale and I think the New York Film Festival as well. Did you enjoy this excursion into the film world, or did you try to stay out of it?
Well, I think you said it all, and I'm a modest person, so I'd rather, you know, maybe not answer the question. The film is by Dimitris Atiridis, who followed the process of making of Documenta 14 in Athens and in Kassel for over 2 years, and then worked for 6 years on like editing the film and bringing it to final form. It premiered last year, so you can see what this Documenta was, 14 episodes, and playing in major film festivals globally.
And did you have to explain what Documenta was, or was that interesting to see maybe how another field of culture sees Documenta? Was it interesting to you to see how the film scene looked at Documenta? Was there any difference from the art world?
No, it wasn't interesting. And I'm basically here because I wanted to, you know, think of Okwi Envezor, who is not here, and also I was, you know, a long time hesitating and thinking what kind of use could be made of me here and if I could be of any use for this panel. And I thought I would basically do it like somehow personally for one particular person who passed on 10th of May this year, which was Koyo Kuo. And Koyo used to be, you know, in this selection committee, the Findungskommission of Documenta. So in a way, the fact that I was appointed in the end as artistic director of Documenta 14 was a sort of pledge, I thought, because her presence was, you know, very important for me in terms of like, how do I now deal with this appointment, you know, mm-hmm. if Koyo was like in this group. So I think this was a major inflection on my thinking on, you know, composition of the curatorial team and kind of like lineup, if you can use this word, of Documenta 14 in both cities and the kind of larger concept of decentering it, you know. Mm-hmm.
All right, we will come back to this, I promise, but we have one more person on the panel that I would like to introduce, and you three, you've already made a Documenta happen. You're in the middle of making one happen. Welcome, Naomi Beckwith. You are the deputy director of the Guggenheim Museum in New York, and also chief curator. You just put on co-curated a show by Rashid Johnson, which I read very good things about. And of course, you're also the artistic director of Documenta 17. And I don't know if you read the HNA newspaper today. There was a quiz about Documenta, and the question of Documenta 16 was, what do you have in common with the new Pope? Do you know the answer?
Firstly, thank you for the introduction, Saskia. And I like to think that you're not a prophetess. You're an amazing, amazing writer. But you mentioned that I might be curating Documenta 17, which is a scary talk.
Well, weren't we going to look into the future? 16,
yes.
Sorry.
Yes, exactly.
27,
Documenta 16.
And
what do I have in common with the Pope? I think what they mean is that we're both fans of the Chicago White Sox, because we are both from the South Side of Chicago. But yes, South Side. However, there is something else that he claims that we have in common, and this is his claim, not mine, but the Pope also mentions that his family has roots in New Orleans and is part of a Creole community from that region, and as such, he's very open about the African roots of that community. And so I actually just want to applaud him for actually talking about the ways in which his cultural history, his family background, is some one that has been intertwined with the history of diaspora and cultural mixing in the United States.
And I think another thing which you have in common is that the process of selection is very mysterious, and there was no white smoke. There actually was white smoke in Documenta 14 coming out of the Friedrichianum, but when you were selected as the head of Documenta 16, it was, I guess it's not a secret to say that it was during a turbulent time for the institution, to say the least. Did you feel like a wholehearted yes to this decision, or was there a small part of you that said, oh dear?
Okay, look, let's be honest. With a project this big, I wake up every day going, oh dear. Like, there's no exception to that. But look, you decide that you are going to do Documenta the day you accept the invitation to apply. And it is the world's largest honor for any curator to be given the charge of this exhibition. You want, of course, or I would want, the fullness of time to create a project, one that is worthy of these beautiful peers here. But I think that there is no organization, institution, whatever you want to call it in the world, that allows you to bring together such an incredible array of voices, but allows you as a curator to imagine what form does curating need to take right now. And so this invitation to not only a mass artist, but actually rethink what curating is at this moment and what it means to bring art to audiences is the most wonderful thing that could happen to a curator.
Maybe I'll pass this on to you, Roger, because I think that is one of the very special things about Documenta, that, of course, every edition is somehow inventing a new world, but you're standing on the shoulders of giants, basically, and then becoming giants yourself, because other curators will react to each and every Documenta. And as a curator, when you started, can you maybe say what was interesting about the history of Documenta for you?
The space, I would say. I mean, I'm still deeply impressed. I mean, when I look at photographs of the 1955 Documenta. So it's not so much the art. I mean, this can be debated. But the idea that you set up a ruin, basically, and try to reinvent it as a public space. I mean, given Germany's history in 1955. So this was for me the key element. And of course, we were also discussing what it, I mean, it's not a nostalgic perspective. No one wants to go back to 1955, but this is the level you should address. I mean, and that's also quite particular, I think, for Documenta. I mean, this ethico-aesthetic perspective. So it's not an art show, but it's also public space. And again, a public space is not given. So what does it do when you bring art to it and audiences? So this is a key thing, or this was a key question for us.
And Carolyn, you also had a curatorial concept that let things from the past and things from the present collide in a way and maybe create something new. I think this is also something you can learn from Documenta, that being contemporary doesn't mean something was made right now. It can be looked at a very precise moment. So maybe you can talk about this aspect in your Documenta. Yeah, it's a big question, I know.
Well, Yes, it is. It is. So before answering and letting the subconscious work a little bit, I take the opportunity to applaud my colleague, Naomi Beckwith, and give her all my best wishes for the next documenta, which I will come and see. And that said, I think you are referring to the brain. So it was not part of the concept. I mean, the concept of documenta was to entangle and explore different fields of knowledge in relation to looking at the world from the perspective not necessarily only of the human subject. So also from the perspective of the meteorite, from the perspective of the sculpture. When you mentioned human, you were speaking about a dog with a pink paw, which was part of the compost of Pierre Huyghe in the Aue Park. And in that, there was also a relationship between a beehive and a copy.
We will see a picture later, so we were going to talk about this work. Okay?
But I'm trying to answer your question. The beehive was on the head of a Max Weber, of a copy of a Max Weber sculpture in a garden in Germany, so modernist sculpture. So there, what I was setting up was, from the perspective of your very interesting question, what I was setting up was an alliance between the non-humans that construct the world with us as a form of coevolution, and the artworks and art objects of the past that were shielded by the non-human. This is the meaning of the beehive on the head of the Max Weber. It's a protection of art, in a way. It's an alliance for a kind of protection. My mother was an archaeologist, and as a child, I saw many, many things. And I remember, as all of us, not children of archaeologists, looking either at pictures or really being there, the void, the absent spaces in Pompeii, which are actually the spaces left from the carbon-based organisms, which are humans, when that goes away, and there's just the shape of this absent human, which is defending from the ashes of Pompeii. So these elements were at the core of why the brain was made. And most of the historical works, this aspect you are referring to, were only in the brain. They weren't all over the documenta. They weren't everywhere. And the brain, indeed, constructed it was like a node out of which different lines went different places. So the Bactrian sculptures, for example, we had 10% in the documenta. 10% of all the Bactrian sculptures that exist on the planet Earth. While thousands of years ago, there must have been thousands of them. But they are very fragile because they need to be composed. The head is separate. The arms are separate. The body is separate. But they fit so perfectly together. So the fact that we had 8 out of the 80 that are known in the world means both that art is lost, that art is destroyed, that the Bamiyan Buddhas are destroyed, that cities and museums are bombed by humans. And it also means that there is care, a form of care that humans have that can transport those 80 Bactrian princesses up to today. And that care is what the artists do. That's exactly what the artists do. And this is the lesson from, for example, Mario Merz or many, many of the Arte Povera artists come from that position of care of, for example, Etruscan sculpture or pre-Socratic Greek thought or Heraclitus or Lucretius. It's a position of care which traditionally is normal. You know, before we invented restoration, modern restoration and conservation, it was always the artists who took care of the artist before and fix, you know, Raffaello would fix something that he didn't like in the proceeding. And we would never do that today. In our aseptic society. So I was trying to bring somehow back this feeling of commitment and life as an alliance. And in order to make that alliance between the human and the non-human, I had to bring very ancient things. I hope that's an answer.
That is very much of an answer. Thank you. Adam, I know that you said that you're not at the moment so much interested to talk about details of Documenta 14, but I rewatched the press conference that you gave when you were appointed. You brought two catalogs, I think one of the Documenta 1 and one of Documenta 10. So maybe a bit more a wider question. Do you think it is useful to look at Documenta as an institution to understand the problems that we're facing at the moment? You were quite interested in the ruin, right? In the ruin of an institution.
Yeah, I mean, there is some advantages of history for life. And I think in terms of, you know, migration, we had several works in Documenta that were looking at the migration of peoples or, you know, individuals through works of several artists, and maybe to begin with one work that kind of prompted us to invite Lois Weinberger again, which was the work he made here in Kassel in Documenta 10, curated by Katrin David, who is absent today. And that work on Gleis 1, which has particular historical significance for in Kassel and for many people in Kassel, consisted of planting the neophyte, you know, plants from South and East Europe on the tracks of that platform, which I think is both reflection on history and the kind of political gesture pointing to a future, and that future became painfully present in the year 2006 on April 4th when Halit Yozgat was murdered here in Kassel. And then, you know, the reason why we, for instance, would bring forensic architecture into Documenta and investigate a part of circumstances of that murder here in Kassel was very much, you know, part of a kind of long lineage of works in this exhibition that are not, you know, about plants as such, but they're about plants very specifically. And in Caroline's Documenta, there was a work by Natasha Sadhajijian, I believe, which sort of, you know, the path that was crossing the, what later became known as, I think, Rosenhang. So, you know, under those roses, there is ruins. And this is what we wanted to look into. You know, the arch would be more or less from 1939, the Reichsgartenschau, which was organized by Hermann Mattern, among others, who was then in, you know, the committee or one of the committees organizing the first Documenta, the Gruppe 53. And then to 1955, when the Bundesgartenschau became the, you know, the setting or on which margin Documenta, then without number, the first ever Documenta would be organized, and so on and so forth. So I think that there is a kind of understanding of history through both, like, living and non-living, you know, actors and substances found in this city and elsewhere that we try to elaborate on in the exhibition, among other things, of course.
And I think the forensic architecture work in general, it also showed the problems with art as evidence, because I think in some kind of trial or parliamentary gremium, it was rejected as a sort of proof, but I think it really changed the conversation around the NSU in Germany. Do you share this view?
Yeah, I think what art can do is to change conditions of conversation. You know, I'm not a lawyer, and we are not lawmakers. We can just make proposals, you know, and make them loud and make them public. And that's what artists do. And I think that, you know, this is the right, and this should not be, you know, this should be somehow protected, perhaps not necessarily by the German constitution only in particular gazettes, or but in general kind of understanding or common sense of, you know, thinking humanity. It's good to have.
When we talk about the history of document, it's been a very sort of classically transatlantic thing. So the U.S. artists, also the U.S. government, it had a big influence on Documenta, also with positioning it as part of the free world against the Eastern Europe and so on during the Cold War. And so now we have a U.S.-American curator again, but I think conditions are very different because Documenta has changed a lot. It has broadened its view and maybe also learned that a Weltkunstschau does not mean it's Europe and the U.S., thankfully. But I guess there's still some work to do to maybe think about what this transatlantic connection is. Is that something that's interesting to you?
To Naomi, yes. Yes. I'm always interested in, I guess, the migration of forms, to use Roger's phrase. For me, I don't know if the core of how I'm thinking about Documenta is really just about this transatlantic relationship, because I do think that the world is big. And if anything, Documenta has done this sort of work over the years of really thinking about geographies that had not been previously included. And so, yes, you do see this big leap in Documenta 5, especially bringing in a lot of Americans hopping the pond. But then, really, especially with Catherine David's Documenta, she began to say that maybe we shouldn't just include these sort of northern alliances. We shouldn't just be thinking about a U.S.-Western Europe relationship, but really bring in these conversations globally. I think the challenge, really, of my Documenta and the ones going forward is a question of when do you exhaust that model? You know, how do you not turn the curator into a kind of Indiana Jones figure who's just going, you know, everywhere, the most exotic places around the world? But how do we think about a question of values, and how do we think about a question of tradition and aesthetics, and how do we allow those things to sit beside each other in conversation in the space of an exhibition? So this can't be an exhibition that's just about capture. Right, capturing the next exotic place, but really an exhibition that's about exchange and dialogue and cultural understanding.
And as a... And I guess one thing that's quite special for curators who work internationally is that they come to Kassel, to a place that is very much shaped by Documenta, but it's also watching a curator quite closely. I guess it's probably not the same as curating Venice, for example. You're probably not as present and as embedded.
Casino.
Yes. So maybe first to you, Roger, how did you experience that of, like, if you wanted or not, becoming such a big part of the Kassel society?
Well, you have no choice. But it was probably different for German speaking team, because I mean, there's also an aspect we haven't touched upon yet, but there's also kind of conversation going on between the various Documenta exhibitions. I mean, some of those references were mentioned. But of course, I mean, there was a very strong conversation, for example, between Ockby's Documenta and Documenta 12. So there was no need, in a way, I mean, to extend Ockby's model. Go to Delhi, go to Santa Lucia, and so on and so forth. Because it was evident that many of those people were actually living here in Kassel. So you have a healthy post-migrant society, second, third generation, and you could actually involve people in a different manner and have this kind of micropolitical globality here in Kassel and extend it. I mean, this is a reason why we're very happy, I mean, to have the cooperation of the Schlachthof, for example. That was a center that that existed and that would also survive Documenta. So this is a kind of model of working in a city or of working locally and cross, I mean, this false distinction, I mean, between the local and the global.
And you seem to agree, but then you still took Documenta to Kabul and to Egypt and to Canada. Why did you think this was necessary?
Well, I agree because the local question was very important to me. I believe the worldly companions were mentioned. I wanted to break the top-down idea of education to art as if someone needs to illuminate, you know, other humans with their knowledges, and often it makes it difficult to actually see the work. So the alliance between the daily life of people from Kassel, their knowledges in other fields, whether it was medicine or gardening or a lawyer or a baker, the alliance between those art historical knowledges that they had and what they learned from the artists during a kind of university that we did to have the artists explain their works to them and introduce them to art, produced a form of radicamento, of rootedness of the exhibition, I think, which still goes on. I meet people in the street and they say, I was a worldly companion, you know. So I think that there is no contradiction between the structure of Documenta 13 from the perspective of the world at large and the needed relationships and rootedness in the place you are. So you indirectly asked me why. Well, I think it was a necessary development that begins actually with Catherine David, who proposed to do Documenta also outside of Kassel, and it was rejected. But her proposal makes the roots of a question, which is, how can a world exhibition be a colonial fair where things from all over the world are shipped to Paris in 1850? You know, there's something unethical and absurd in that. So she began a process which Okwi Enwezor, the dear and late Okwi, brilliant, continued with his platforms, and the fifth platform was the exhibition in Kassel. But the others, they were platforms, meaning that they were meetings. They were conversations between people in all these different locations. So what I did built on that, it was not a new idea. It was building on that and thinking about how you can avoid opening a Lufthansa office all over the world, but make meaningful things in relation to positions of subjectivity. So I was interested in four positions, you know, of the artist. What does an artist do when they are on stage? And Kassel is the stage. You know, when you show a work here, Thomas Bayerle decided to show the huge plane. So what does a subject do when they are on stage? Or what does an artist do, actually? And then what does an artist do in a state of hope? And that's why I was thinking of the Arab Spring, and Cairo and Alexandria happened because of that. And I realized they don't do art. In a state of hope, they build a world. They make cups, posters. They build a world. And so Weil Schalke would never pick up the phone. He was always in the middle of trying to build a new Egypt. And then I was thinking about, and in fact, Alexandria, Cairo is the only place where there was no exhibition. So there was no art there. There was a state of hope. We were discussing how you can rebuild democracy on other bases. And, you know, hope often doesn't really bring to success, sadly. But I choose to stay in a state of hope. And also on stage, here we are. Then there is, I was thinking about the retreat. You know, what is the position of retreat in the emergent social media digitalization of the world? And Banff was a solo exhibition of Brian Jungen because of that. And Banff is a place where there are more bears than people. And
except when Documenta artists arrive.
No, there was one, Brian Ryungen, and then Pierre came. Pierre Wig. No, no, absolutely not. It was about the retreat. It was consisting in a retreat, and it was important to me to not choose three other places that are of the so-called global south. I don't like these categorizations of. I never like categorizations. I think categorizations put people in cages and take away freedom. So it was important to pick this place where there are bears. And then the last place was Kabul. And why Kabul is because the fourth position was, what does an artist do under siege? So what does an artist do when it's illegal to paint? And so in Germany, they used watercolor because you couldn't smell the oil paint if the police came when it was illegal. You know, many expressionist artists have only watercolors of certain years. So what does an artist do under siege? And so I wanted a similar place to what Kassel was when Documenta started. So what Kabul was a place that was occupied by its liberators. So we had Italians, Americans, Canadians, Germans, French, occupying a place that had been liberated shortly before from the first Taliban regime. But there were still snipers and all sorts of things. When we went, the plane had to turn off the motors and turn off the lights, and we glided down onto the pista. The audience couldn't come. Nobody could get a tourist visa. It was complicated. I was trying to understand what it was like in 1955, or when Baudet thought about in 48. His first idea was in 48 when he went to see Venice, and he decided to do an exhibition which would be of the world, but without national pavilions. He wanted to go against these strong nationalisms because of what had happened with extreme nationalism. So I wanted to find a place where the condition of the artists, you know, whether they were... I think I answered the question, though, so...
Yeah, I was wondering...
It would maybe, be similar, would yeah. be similar.
I think we can maybe move on to Athens for 1 minute, because once an idea is in the world, it cannot be taken back, basically. And I think in Athens you were interested, Adam, correct me, in a country in crisis, but also in a European structuring crisis with the repressive handling of the refugee crisis, with the financial crisis, with the austerity politics. And so you took Documenta to Athens. Do you think it changed the DNA of Documenta because Athens will now just be a part of it?
Well, I don't see Documenta as an organism. I see it as a kind of ideological construct changing in time and in changing historical conditions and material conditions. So I don't know if it changed anything to the DNA of Documenta, but I get it's a metaphor. So the question is, you know, whether it changed. No, I think, you know, each Documenta invented its own ways. And as we know, there were attempts several times to take it away from Kassel with, you know, more or less energy put in such an endeavor. And there was even once a proposal to bring it to the U.S., you know, which didn't really work in the early 70s, I think, or mid-70s. I don't know really. It was not my intention to, you know, change the DNA of Documenta. The idea was to try to act from kind of now point of view. And I thought that the plight of Greece and other countries of the European South, such as Italy, Portugal, and Spain, which were termed pigs, basically, and did not belong to the civilized family of northern European nations at that time, was something quite interesting in this new European world after the Cold War. You know, there was a new division taking shape, or it was a frontier of a larger division between what I do believe is, you know, what could be termed global south, and what could be termed, you know, the neoliberal order that is, strangely enough, originating in the Western Europe and the U.S. So I think this sort of battle lines were of interest when trying to think, you know, how to begin with Documenta back then in 2013. And yeah, that's more or less what I would.
So Naomi, if you're inspired by this plan to take Documenta to the US, you can say it now.
Thank you.
But
can I add something to what Adam said? I think also, Adam, if I may semi-quote you, I remember you also saying that you wanted to think about Castle both as a host and a guest. And here you want to think about, let's say, Documenta in Castle being hosted by the city, whereas in Athens, the castlers would have to behave as a guest. Documenta would have to behave as a guest. And for me, that's always been an interesting model about what it means to be in the world. I think we are in a moment where these questions of who gets to move, who gets to migrate, how easily, and again, what the curator does when one is moving around the world, is so predicated on this idea of having the freedom to roam. But I also think having a bit of humility and acting as a guest rather than, let's say, the leader coming to extract ideas or art all the time is actually, for me, has been a really important model.
And maybe watching Documenta or having watched Documenta from the U.S., I think your first one was 13 to see in real life, so.
The first one I saw was 13. The first one I heard of was Holger, who introduced me to the very idea of Documenta as he was planning it, yes.
Yeah, because in Germany we do like to think that Documenta is sort of the center of the art world universe. So looking at an art world which is super global, which has like literally hundreds of biennales and platforms, festivals, whatever, what would you say, like maybe from an outside perspective, do you think Documenta is still a relevant institution today?
I mean, no doubt it's relevant. I think it's a question of, in a world that even sometimes people don't call global anymore, right? We call it multipolar, right? There's many centers around the world. I will go back to the phrase that I said at the very beginning, still the apotheosis of a curatorial career is here at Documenta. It is still remains the most experimental and probably the last one that allows this deep, deep level of thinking and reformation of every edition.
So maybe a bit humbling for us as well. So
you should be proud.
I asked every one of you to bring one image actually from your Documenta or related to your Documenta. Maybe we can see the first one. It should be Ruger's, I hope. Yes, we have, I think it's the Friedrichsplatz, and it's a tiny little poppy flower very bravely making its way out of the earth. So I guess it's part of Sanja Ivikovic's work. And so apparently you didn't choose one of the known installation image where the poppy is in full bloom, but you chose the process. So maybe the process is as...
This is an after image, actually.
So it's a remainder.
I mean, I could have done it today.
But this idea of not picking like the polished one, but maybe also picking the work and the struggle it is to...
I think it's quite polished, this image. Don't you think?
It's brave. I found it quite metaphorical, so this flower wouldn't be defeated. But do you think that this idea of art being successful was somehow challenged by your Documenta? Because we had the collapse of Ai Weiwei's work, and then he said it's better than before. So I think it made many people think about, can art fail at all? So is there something good that came out of your Documenta?
Well, this is a question you should not ask me, but what is success? I mean, I think this doesn't get us anywhere. I mean, the point is if an image lingers, right? And then often you don't know why. I mean, you look at things and maybe you don't take them seriously, but then after 3 weeks you start dreaming about it, or you remember it after 5 years or so. And I think in relation to Sanja's work, this is quite meaningful. I mean, I found journalists particularly idiotic, I mean, at the press conference, because they were expecting the field to blossom, to bloom. But why? Yeah? I mean, this is not a federal garden show. I mean, this is precisely the difference between Documenta and a federal garden show. And then when all those people come for the opening, and of course they get the image, what happens after 3 weeks or after 2 months, I mean, to the visitor? So, I mean, playing with expectations is one of the curatorial tricks. Again, as Karin said, not invented by us, right? The image is also meaningful because it refers, I mean, to the artist's intention. I mean, this is a work about death, about absence. But then it continues somehow. I mean, those flowers reappear. I mean, Adam tried to smash it with this Parthenon of forbidden books, but this has disappeared, the Parthenon, but this tiny flower still claims its own life. And also referring, I mean, to, I never wanted to leave a trace in Kassel, at least not a material one. So I get irritated when I walk through a city by art. I don't want to see art when I walk in a city. But it was meaningful, for example, to contribute those benches. So this is a secret between Andreas Hoffmann and me. This is my contribution, actually, as an artistic director to the city of Kassel. So this is a kind of public art that I find useful, and so on and so forth.
So whenever we see a poppy in Kassel, we will think of you, or we already do. And Carolyn, you also brought a living being, actually. So if you continue, maybe we go to the next one first. There should be a dog in the next one. Yes, there we are. So this is a picture of Pierre Hugues' Untilled area in the Aue. Composed, yeah. It's untilled, I think, no?
Untilled.
Just untilled, okay. And so you've already talked about the work a little bit in the beginning. And here we have a scene where there was also a growing work. So it changed during Documenta a lot. So it was an organism in the show.
Yes, well, it was a compost.
Yeah.
We must remember that Pierre Hugues was also part of the agents of Documenta. So he knew everything that was going on in terms of other artists and the whole project. Donna Haraway was on this advisory committee. So we were talking a lot about composting, which is a word that she used after Documenta. So, but what can I say? I described it already, the sculpture, the alliance. You want to ask me why it's pink? I won't tell you.
One image that
lingers
for you.
But it has to do with painting. So in a way, it's a landscape painting. And it also was generating life. So there were tadpoles growing. It was more than an organism. It was a world being born, and it was composting culture and non-human culture. For example, there are secrets to it. There is a dead boys' tree that was eaten by ants. There are pieces left over from Dominique Gonzalez Forster, the stones. So he was composting human cultural production and non-human cultural production together, in like a form of what Lynn Margulis, who would have had the Nobel Prize had she not died of cancer before, but would call like a form of endosymbiosis.
And I guess you know that human, the dog,
She's passed.
But she lived in Kassel for many years.
Of course, that was very important.
Lingering.
That was very important because every single thing was premised on at least trying to discuss and think about all the ethical questions, like the question that Naomi pointed out of being a guest. You know, this was a very, very important issue in Afghanistan, very important. And there was also, therefore, a whole house here that was taken over by all of the Afghan artists who were exhibiting in Kassel as well. So there are many, many questions about balance and equilibrium. In this particular case of human, of course, Pierre wanted a dog that would be very skinny and look not well kept. But he's a species of dog which is bred to be like that. And the dog was coming from, it was saved from a kennel. It wasn't, you know, bought in a shop for dogs. It was saved. And the dog, I didn't want to have the dog taken care of by someone and then that someone would go away. So part of the job brief that Bernd Leifeld, the equivalent of our dear Mr. Hoffman, Dr. Hoffman now, Bernd Leifeld, I said, you have to hire someone and the person has to be the owner of the dog for their whole life. So, you know, to get paid for 3 months and then have a dog for the rest of your life is hard.
But I think it was two because Senor, the puppy was.
Yeah. But I can't tell all the stories or take up too much time. But so the owner of the dog became actually the true owner. So the reality and the fiction overlapped, and they lived together the entire life of human, and human became also an actor and performer in Pompidou and Lakma in many places, always with the same owner. There are hundreds of thousands of these kind of ethical questions that are posed when you make an exhibition.
So I guess we move to Friedrichianum now with Adam Timchik's picture. You already mentioned it as well. It's Banu Cenetolu's work, Being Safe is Scary. And it's quite I think it's interesting you chose this one because politically, at this moment, we're told the opposite, like, we have to be safe and we have to defend ourselves. But why is being safe scary?
Well, I think this work was exactly in this. It was a response to this kind of condition of imposed security, you know, in terms of like how we are supposed to move and to, you know, talk and so forth. So like kind of regulation of or constraints imposed on human behavior, and also the important part of the work was to make the conventional character of this architecture parlant of the Friedrichianum problematic. So to, you know, by a simple gesture of removing the inscription, you basically make the building speak anew and become like any building. You know, you can imagine different uses of the building. And this building was once a library, for instance. You know, the fact that it was a museum, and one says that it was the first museum open to the public, you know, the question immediately is what kind of public, which class, which social class could visit Friedrichianum, what became the, you know, the museum on the turn of, in the late 18th century. So this were, and also, of course, it's a kind of central locus of Documenta inevitably. So we tried to shift balances there, and the Parthenon was also almost like an oversized, you know, response to this kind of neoclassical, you know, facade. So it played a role there. On the one hand, the Parthenon, you know, referring to the kind of specifically German love of everything Greek, as long as it doesn't get, you know, too near. So when it's contemplated through, you know, the lens of imagined or constructed Greek philosophy, Greek culture, the sort of mythologie blanche of Greece, in which, you know, there is a kind of Platonic idea embodied in this immaculate white Greek sculpture. So these were pretty much the issues that I think Bano had in mind when putting this inscription on the front of the museum.
Thank you. And for Naomi's image, we have to think a bit around the corner, maybe, because you don't have images of Documenta 16 yet. But you have an image of a work by, I wrote it down, or you can say it, Annabella Geiger. And I think you are in the image too, because you took it, right? Is there like your silhouette in the image?
Is that me? Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry.
That's yes, right. That's me. I like read it as a metaphor. No. So why did you bring this image?
I brought this image up because I just become interested in the work of this artist. This is a Brazilian-born artist, born in the 1930s, someone who for most of her life has been deeply interested in map-making and cartography. Her husband, in fact, was part of the team that began to partition Brazil into states. And so they both, as a couple, would constantly sort of travel around the terrain. And it was her husband's job, I mean, he's 103 and still alive today, to literally make borders. And so Annabella Geiger has been and still is deeply interested in what it means to understand a place, this image, but also understand a place with your body, something that you take on in a physical way that could feel disjointed, that could feel sensory rather than just something represented on a page. And many of the ways in which she does that is by sort of breaking down an image, in this case, this kind of isthmus between North and South America, this land bridge, and sort of recasting it over and over and over again. She calls this a kind of geopoetics. And I'm really interested in what it means to turn the world into a form of poetry, the image of the world into a form of poetry. But I'm mostly interested in what does it mean to live in a sense of a cut-up world right now, and one in which its organization doesn't make sense either on paper or even to our bodies in some ways. And so these kind of questions of multipolarity and the distinction between what we see, what we feel, and how we experience the being on Earth and across borders is still occupying me.
And maybe that brings me to one of the questions that I found interesting in the history of Documenta, because I think we've heard it's been a platform for art that is asking these questions, like questioning institutions, questioning politics, questioning borders, for example. But it's also one of the biggest institutions that we have, so it also embodies these things, basically. So between being sort of critical towards them and also embodying them, is that something you think about?
Yeah, but I don't know if I think about the totality of Documenta as an institution. Yes, it has an institutional reputation, but I think that there's a way in which Documenta itself is a framework. And within that framework, many kinds of experimentations and improvisations happen. To call it just an institution implies that there is one way of doing things over and over and over again. And I think we've already seen the multiplicity of models and approaches and the ways in which what is urgent in the world for artists, but even for, you know, citizens of the world, gets expressed and explored in different ways every time. So I like to push back a little bit on the idea of a document as just an institution. Again, it's a framing, it's a platform, but what happens inside, as you said at the beginning, is pure wildness, and it's beautiful.
I think, Roger, you caught, yeah. I read an interview by you, Roger, where you called it a beast. So the role of the curator is to unleash it or to tame it?
No, I just wanted to assume the role of the beauty. No, but to come back, I mean, to what Naomi just said, I mean, we just have to remember, I mean, those events a couple of months ago, where everyone could learn or watch life, I mean, how precarious the institution, in fact, is. And how big the temptation, I mean, to get access to it from whatever side. And, of course, I mean, we have heard the words of the political representatives, but again, I think it would be mistaken, I mean, to associate the notion of institution with anything that reeks of stability. So in this sense, I mean, I could go back to Banu's or to Adam's peace. I think this should also be the life motto of this non-institution. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, Caroline, I know that freedom of art is one of your key topics that you talk about a lot and have thought about a lot. And I think we're seeing that after Documenta 15, people were very worried about the state of artistic freedom in Germany. So if you want to comment on your view on that, I know it's tricky, but I think it's also important to talk
very
about
tricky.
It.
Very tricky.
I know.
Thank you for the question. well, yes, I have been lecturing. First thing, I really enjoyed Documenta 15. I came back many times. I enjoyed it. The reason I enjoyed it is that it was the most different from mine. I've seen lots of documentas, as you know, from Schneckenburger onwards, and I really like things when they are radically opposite from what I would do. When it's just a little different, you know. But I'm more challenged in a situation where I find true radical experimentation opposite to what I would do. So I did come back many times, and I was very sad that there were so many polemics, because I believe in Documenta very much. We have very few. It's not an institution necessarily. It sort of is, but it isn't really. But we have very few spaces where we have been able to be free. Very few. After World War II. And it's true, there are all these studies by Canadian art historians about how the CIA was involved in 1959 and blah, 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 blah. It's true, but it's marginal in my view. It's a marginal aspect of when politics tries to use soft power. But they have no idea what art is, and therefore they cannot really do this task of soft power. So, that said, but this is, I forget the discourse. We have to stop clapping because I forget what I need to say, what I want to say. I'm now 67 and my memory is not the same as before. Don't clap. So, where was I? So, the premise, I'm beating around the bush. Yes, so I think that a democracy is strong if it can withstand absolute and total artistic freedom. Germany happens.
We can do it afterwards.
Yeah, Germany happens to have this written in the Grundgesetz, and I think it's interesting because it's not written in the Italian Constitution, it's not written in the American Constitution, it's not written in anyone. And this is because of the drama of what had happened to artists before here. So, it's explicit. And what this means is that it's not synonymous as freedom of expression. Freedom of expression is in all those constitutions. But freedom of expression is vague because it means your expression, my expression, her expression. Now, I understand that hate crimes can be regulated by laws that according to each society, they decide will be necessary to somehow in a Hobbesian, although I don't believe in Thomas Hobbes's idea, I actually don't, but if we do accept this idea that's written in the Leviathan, then we could say that there is limits to freedom of expression within each society. But that has nothing to do with artistic expression, where someone should be able to do anything, and I mean anything, something that's... Now, we don't need to give examples, but I always remember cases on one extreme and cases on the other extreme, you know, because we also have cases on the on many extremes. You know, the case of Ezra Pound. How can you do that? Put a poet like Ezra Pound in a cage in Pisa. But thank God they put him in the cage in Pisa. And as we know, he was a disaster politically. You know, he was a fascist. He was a disaster. So no excuse from a personal perspective. But he revolutionized poetry. And thank God, art always trumps everybody else. It always trumps everyone. Because he wrote the Pisan cantos. The cantos from number 60 to whatever were written in a cage. I mean, after the experience of being in a cage. So for this reason, it's okay because the artists will always solve it. On the other extreme, we had Mario Merz in prison under the fascists. So the opposite extreme. And he began to draw spirals. And from those spirals comes the Fibonacci, comes the igloo, comes everything after. So I'm always an optimist, even when art is repressed by different societies at different times. And I also, not only am an optimist, but I believe in Theodor Adorno theory about language. You know, often language is used, it's like the opposite of what it is in a way. It's a strange thing that happens with language. So we cannot look at words as meaning something absolute. You know, they change in their meaning after a year, 2 years, 3 years, 50 years. So we don't even know what people are saying. Nobody knows. Because we are spoken by language. We do not speak language. We are spoken by language. Therefore, the summary is, yes, I've been giving lectures about artistic freedom. And I think that a society is strong only if it can accept fully the test. You know, it's a test. And then, by the way, you know, we do art, you know, it doesn't really have that much impact. People are so afraid of art. I don't understand, you know, we are in our little corner.
I guess one of the things that, a hopeful way to put it, is that a place like Documenta could be a place to ask these questions and to have these conflicts, but to... So. No? Okay, you can...
Something.
Okay.
I don't think so. I agree totally with Roger, that the journalists, I mean, I hope I don't alienate everyone, but now I'm retired, so I can alienate the journalists here. I believe that the journalists are always dragging down the discussion to, you know, what shoes the politician is wearing, what color this is ridiculous. I mean, we are the biggest disaster that is coming. The biggest disaster is the stupidification of people, of humans, also because of the prosthetic devices we are inventing of, you know, generative AI and algorithms. And the more we invent prostheses to become more intelligent, the more stupid most people are. They don't study. They don't think. So we shouldn't take the questions down. We can't take them down. We have to keep them on a philosophical level, in my view. My neighbors don't have to agree. But they have to keep them a little bit higher up.
To that too. I would like...
We're
to,
a journalist.
That's
I'm
okay.
So sorry.
We're used to it. It's fine. But I would be interested in what's facet of the question of artistic freedom, which is huge, I know that, but which facet of this discussion interests you, Adam, at the moment?
I'm not interested in the concept of artistic freedom. I think it's massively overblown, and it's a replacement for any serious discussion about, you know, specific issues. it serves very often as a fig leaf for politicians who, in their way, are, you know, not only politicians, but also the kind of thinkers behind who introduce their own rules and then, you know, juxtapose these rules with the idea of artistic freedom that remains abstract. Each attempt to exercise artistic freedom concretely is met with resistance, and sometimes this resistance leads to a conflict. And we've seen many of such conflicts during, you know, 70 years of Documenta. We can write a book about, you know, and this is not about scandals, controversies, and so forth, because calling it scandals and so on, you know, is a way to make things quite facile and palatable through the media, how things are mediatized. Then, you know, then there was a scandal, you know, the scandal lives maybe for 2 weeks and then it's over. The discussion that results stays a little longer, and I think what happened in Documenta 15 left an indelible mark on the discussion in Germany, you know, about memory politics, about the limits of also freedom of research in universities and so on and so forth. So we are facing, in a way, not the consequence, but you know, the development in this process, to which also belong, you know, political events outside of Germany until now. So art has relatively modest role in this, but it can serve, you know, as something that allows to kind of channel public emotions. And that's why I think journalists have particular responsibility. I wouldn't say, you know, journalists are bad and, you know, the philosophers are great. I think it doesn't really work like this. And it's just that being a writer today and, you know, writing for newspapers or for internet or whatsoever is a very particular responsibility. And things have to be addressed seriously and not just judged instantly, you know. Maybe judgment has to be a little bit suspended, you know, and time should be taken.
And if we look at the history, again, we've seen Documenta happening and thriving in a way in very different political situations. But Naomi, what would you say, what does Documenta need? What would you say Documenta needs to become what you want it to be as a context?
Wow, that's an amazing question, which I, oddly enough, I've never asked myself, seeing how it is my job. I think that actually, I think the Lord Mayor said this best, which is to say that I think we need an audience that's ready to get uncomfortable at times. And that doesn't mean there's not going to be moments of incredible joy and jouissance, but I think we all need to prepare ourselves to be challenged and sit with that discomfort at times.
And I have so many more questions, but looking at my watch, I think we're going to wrap it up soon, but I have one aspect that I think is interesting and important, because it's the audience, because I think Documenta, and you cannot talk about Documenta without the audience, and maybe also how Documenta created a sort of art audience in Germany that just hasn't existed, and it was a struggle, I think, for many. So maybe that's my last question, if you've learned something from the Documenta audience as a curator.
I agree that the question of the audience is key, and when it comes to Kassel, I mean, it's an extraordinary experience, and it's not a cheap compliment, but you have people who get used to this kind of experience, to this challenge we were discussing before, and this makes me wonder if this is not something that we have to do, or all have to do, on a kind of almost daily basis. It should be a kind of diet, I mean, this confrontation. So it's not just about the one piece or the scandal or the limits or whatever, but it has to do with the general willingness. I mean, to engage in conflicts in an ethical manner. So, I mean, this is a key thing. And in this regard, Kassel could be called a laboratory. I mean, I wouldn't use those technical terms. I mean, only because you want to wrap it up. I put it briefly, but you need this kind of constant engagement. I think this is very important. And in this regard, I mean, the city is amazing, of course.
Can I also just add, we're all also the Documenta audience too, right? I think our position as artistic director doesn't mean that we also aren't sort of participants in the process, and that's also a beautiful thing, to be, you know, sort of at the helm of something, but also there's a beautiful humility to just also take it in.
Do you want to add something? No? Okay, so I guess there were a lot of things we did not talk about, but I'm really happy that we did get to talk about some things, and maybe talking about the audience and mingling, we can still do that at the Friedrichshafen, because we were invited, I think, to go further to the Friedrichshafen and to wrap up the evening and maybe talk to each other more, because I think it's very important to talk about these things. And I thank you all very much. It was very, very interesting. Thank you for sharing your insights into Documenta. And I think thank you for everybody for thinking with us and staying with us. And see you in 2027, I guess, at the latest. Thank you very much.